The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I don't recall how old I am. It's been so long, time has moved at such a rapid pace that the past few centuries seem to have gone by in an instant. I know that Grace only died a few days ago, but it could have been last century for all that time matters to me. Even if it had been 100 years, the grief is still raw and painful. I suppose I shouldn't be expected to cope with her death very well. After all, she'd been one of my only companion in life for millennia. Our bond was formed over hundreds, if not thousands, of lifetimes. It is not a bond one can forget so easily. I'm sure you must wonder just who I am. A vampire, perhaps? Or maybe a demon or evil spirit? I can assure you I'm nothing so malignant or interesting. What I am is simply an old man who has lived for far longer than he has any right to. My biography is long, but not particularly interesting. I was no great hero, I partook in no historical events, and I committed no great atrocities. I simply lived the quiet life most of humanity seems to have aspired to since its dawn. I stayed by the side of my beloved, and together we drifted through time, making the most of our infinite lives. I was born in a city called Yore. My father was a farmer outside the city, and he raised me to do the same. The woman I would marry was named Amaridum. She was beautiful in her youth. We did not marry out of love, but out of necessity. Her father was a wealthier farmer than I, and he had no sons. He needed his heir, and so my marriage to Amaridum was meant as a means of binding our families. Less a labor of love, and more a formal business contract. Still, we were happy together. We had children, we lived our meager lives, raising crop and cattle. Amaridum was as good as a wife as I could have asked for. I'd say that she was before her time. Back then, her intelligence would have meant little to anyone, but I found it impressive. Perhaps some people these days may have called her a genius. She devised more effective ways to tend my crops and animals. Under her instruction, I dug channels to use for irrigation and watched my crop flourish. During a drought, a few years after our marriage, she saw us through it, and while the other farmers around us struggled, we endured all because of her. I would have been content with just that, but Amaridum was not. Her father died relatively young. He'd contracted an infection a few years after our marriage, and I had inherited his lands. While his death was a stroke of good fortune for us, it didn't come without a cost. Pain has remained unchanged throughout the duration of human history, and the loss of her father hurts Amaridum in a way I'd never seen in anyone before. She was different after we buried him, quieter and focused. When she began to take a greater interest in the world around us, I did not stop her. I thought it might be better to allow her to mourn, but she was up to far more than that. She began to study my crop closer, taking samples to prod at. I can't even begin to describe just what she was doing with them. Until the end, she refused to disclose what her process had been. What I do know was that her obsession was with life. We'd had several children during the course of our marriage, although only a handful had survived. Others had either died in infancy or been miscarried. It's the miscarried ones I remember the most. I remember that some of the things that had come out of her seemed properly shaped. Those were the ones she'd kept and worked on. She'd used small knives to cut the miscarried fetuses apart, studying their half-formed bodies. I never watched just what she did to them. Her work was gruesome and it frightened me. At the end, I had considered stopping her, but I truthfully wanted no part of it. 4 years, I ignored her experiments and led her to her own devices. I never questioned any of it. Even when she began to leave during the night and return during ungodly hours of the morning, I never questioned any of it. When our home began to stink with the strange things she'd boiled together, I stayed out in the fields. I knew she was working towards something, but I did not know what. My cattle began to die, never more than one at a time, always the oldest of my flock. One death would occur every few months, and when it did, Amaritim would ask me to dispose of the animal.
"That meat is tainted," she'd say. "Bury it. Give it back to the earth."
I'd never questioned her on that either. Only once did I see just what she was working on during the later stages of it. I was on my way into the house to rest, and I saw her outside, sitting by a fire as she set things into a clay pot. Several strange roots set around her, but those were not what interested me. I spotted something red and small in her hands. It took me a moment to realize that it was a human arm. She'd miscarried every few months at that point, and I knew what that severed arm had once belonged to. I turned to leave her. I can't imagine she saw me. I prayed she didn't. Yet, at that moment, I began to fear my wife. Then, it stopped. Her strange experiments, her late-night disappearances, and the cattle deaths. Occasionally, she would still engage in whatever secretive work she had undertaken, but it seemed almost as if she'd gotten whatever answer she was looking for. Our small farm continued to flourish. Our cattle seemed healthier than ever before, and I prayed that things might return to the way they had once been. I've been working in the fields on the day I became eternal. I came into the house and joined my wife and my son for supper. When we were done, my sons were sent out to watch the animals as they grazed, and I was left alone with my wife, my Amaritim. So many memories of mine have been lost to time, but I'll never forget the way she looked at me that night. Nor shall I forget what she said to me. I haven't spoken Sumerian in so long. I no longer knew the language, but I remember the meaning.
"We've made a life for ourselves, haven't we?"
she asked me. She brought some wine and poured a cup for both of us. "As much as we can," I'd replied. She smiled at me and I drank the wine. It tasted sweeter than usual. I watched as she did the same, drinking deeply. She seemed to savor it, and yet I thought nothing of the reverence behind the way she held that cup. She said,
"You know, we're almost as old as my father was when he died. I still can't believe how sudden it was. It was terrifying, wasn't it? I don't think I ever want to die like that. What about you, Ashmadu?"
The tone in her voice had given me pause. The way she'd smiled, her eyes glowing with triumph, both warmed my heart and unnerved me. "I'd rather die on my own terms," I said softly.
"As would I," she replied. "And we shall."
At the time, I didn't understand her meaning behind that, nor did I grasp the meaning behind her smile. Now, though, now I understand everything. There was no immediate change. Our sons and daughters were married off. Amaritim and I grew older until one of our sons took over the farm, and we waited for death. But death never came, and that gleam never left Amaritim's eye, even as her beauty slowly devolved into wrinkles. She never outright admitted to me what she'd done. We never spoke of her strange experiments or the wine we'd shared. I suppose once I figured out what I was too afraid to confront her. I can't say if I was afraid she'd taken it away from me or what. She was so sure she'd defeated death. But I wondered if she really had. Years became decades. Our sons were replaced with grandsons, and in time we left them behind to start anew. Our bones were old, our skin was wrinkled and leathery, but We were still alive, weren't we? We never went back to Yor. Instead, we traveled. We saw the rise and fall of empires and new civilizations. We saw human history unfold before us. It was a privilege, and yet it did not change the fact that our bones continued to ache more and more with each passing day. And with each passing day, we grew more and more numb to the pain. We changed our names so many times. Apheus and Lelia, Harold and Emily, Thomas and Grace. We lived as best we could. Even under the strain of age, our bodies could still do that much. Whatever concoction my wife had slipped into our wine that night kept us intact enough to do that much. But the pain was still so mind-numbing. While my wife seemed to enjoy the gifts of her immortality, I found myself tortured by it. Even as a young man, the agony I felt in my bones from the simple act of being would have driven me mad, but this agony was as eternal as I was. At times, I wondered if my wife did not feel it too. In thousands of years, she never once said, "I loved my wife, Meridian, Grace, whatever name she went by. I loved her so much, but I don't think she realized the hell that existence was to me. I don't think she cared either. She'd won, she'd achieved her goal, and the fact that our bodies continued to age was of no consequence to her. The past century was the hardest. Moving my body became torture. At thousands of years old, Grace still zipped around like she did back in our old farm, and I resented her for that. The inhale and exhale of my breath was agony. The passive ache in my rotting muscles was too much to bear. In 1892, we had been living in Germany. Our house was modest. We weren't farmers, but we'd accrued enough money to care for ourselves. We had been sitting down to dinner when I looked up at her. Underneath the leathery skin and gray hair, I still saw that eternal twinkle in her eye, although I was sure I saw her wince as she moved her arm to cut her meat. "Do you think it's been too long?" I asked her. She looked back at me, still smiling, and she laughed. "Too long?" she asked. "Can life ever really be too long?" I hadn't said my answer. I knew she would not have accepted it. She never would have. In the end, it was the simplest thing that killed her. A fall down the stairs. Moving my arms to push her was no easy feat. But then again, nothing is easy these days. The mercy is, she died before she'd reached the bottom of the stairs. I remember the way she lay there, crumpled and broken. I remember trying to talk myself into throwing myself down after her, but even after thousands of years, I still did not have the courage. I think I do now, though. We were not meant to be eternal. Even committing this paltry autobiography down on paper has been a chore. I'd like the pain to stop now. I'd like to finally rest. I just hope that my wife understands why I did what I did. And when I answer to her in the next life, I pray she forgives me. I would have never thought that an object as mundane as a chair could cause so much terror in a person's life. Superstition often speaks of cursed objects, but I always found the concept to be laughable. However, the events that transpired the week of October 2nd, 2016 are something that will sit in the pit of my stomach until the day I die. My fiancé and I had just signed the lease on our first home, a modest one-bedroom apartment in an old building. There was nothing particularly amazing about the place, but it was ours, and that alone was enough to fill us with excitement. With my management position at the local diner and Alice part-time waitressing in between college classes, going out and buying brand new furniture was not an option. Luckily, Alice loved thrift shopping and typically knew where to get the best deals. She led me by hand through the aisles of clothes at the Good Finds thrift store near our new place. Against the far back wall sat a myriad of mismatched furniture. Worn wooden tables,
couches with ripped cushions, dressers with half the drawers missing. I scrunched up my face at the smell of the dust and the thought of picking up someone's used, dirty furniture. Still, we were going to need more than just the furniture we currently had.
Seth,
I heard Alice yell from the other side of the furniture section. I headed towards the sound of her voice and found her standing in front of a large armchair. She pointed towards it.
Look how nice this is.
It was made of a deep, blood-red leather, with delicate accents of black running along the edges. The black cushion was studded with a crisscross pattern of polished gold buttons. The buttons curved down the front of each arm as well. It sat upon four square legs made of a dark cherry wood. It was beautiful, but had a sense of darkness to it. I chalked that up to the color of its leather and vintage style. Most importantly, it was in perfect condition. Didn't even look like it had ever been sat on. Alice bent down and peered at the yellowed paper price tag. $20 was written in black marker. She glanced up at me with big eyes. The chair seemed to have some sort of pull on both of us. We knew we had to buy it. After some finagling, we had it in our car and on its way home. Carrying it upstairs to our fourth floor apartment was not as easy as we had hoped. This thing must be really well made, I grunted, trying to hold its weight as we rounded the third staircase. It's so fucking heavy.
I can't believe how cheap it was.
Alice was equally out of breath as she held the top of it, walking backwards up the final staircase. We put it in the corner of our living room, facing the television. It looked like it was meant to be there. The next few days went on without incident. We continued to unpack and decorate on our free nights after work. We explored our new neighborhood when we had the energy to go out. Caught up in the novelty of our new place, the chair went mostly unnoticed. It wasn't until the next Friday night that I was given the first sign that something was wrong. Alice and I had settled in for the night, bowl of popcorn in hand and ready to pop in a movie. One of those classic black and white horror films she loved so much. I plopped down into the chair and immediately sprang back up.
What's wrong?
Alice asked. Two things had happened the moment I had sat down. First, the air around me grew incredibly cold, as if the room had fallen to a frigid temperature in mere moments. Second, the skin on my arm where the chair had touched burned like they had been pressed against hot metal. I dropped the popcorn to the ground without thoughts and began examining my arms where they had been burned. But there was nothing there, not even the slightest bit of redness.
The fuck?
I mumbled. Alice came over to me, gently putting her hands on my arm and looking me over.
Did you hurt yourself?
I don't know. I sat down and it felt like something was burning me. She paused, not exactly sure how to respond.
Well, I don't see anything on your skin. The chair is in front of the window. Maybe the sun was beating down on the leather today.
Yeah, maybe. Although I didn't believe that was the case. The sun had set hours ago. There was no way it should have retained that much heat.
Let me see.
Alice hesitantly lowered herself down onto the chair, lightly touching her fingertips to the leather.
I don't feel anything.
I put my hand to the cushion and felt nothing. No cold air, no burning sensation. It was just a chair. I shrugged and assured her I must have had a weird hot flash or something. I cleaned up the spilled popcorn and changed the subject to turning on the movie. Alice still seemed uneasy by what had happened, but was happy to not dwell on it. We watched the movie in silence, both opting to sit on the futon. It wasn't more than a day or two after that when I noticed the chair began to move. It was subtle at first, seeming to be at a slightly different angle than it was the last time I'd been in the room, or a few inches forward or back from the last time I had looked at it. I told myself I was just imagining things, that my paranoia was getting the best of me. But when I woke up one morning to find that the chair had moved from the corner and now sat in the dead center of the room. I could no longer play it off as my imagination. "Alice," I called.
"What?"
she yelled back from the bedroom, seemingly annoyed at the wake-up call. She groggily stumbled out into the living room. Her eyes widened. "Did you move this?" I asked. She furrowed her brow and shook her head.
"No, you didn't?"
"No." We both sat, unmoving and silent, just staring at it. Alice's breath grew deep and uneven.
"Did something, like, break into our apartment in the middle of the night?"
I looked around the room. "I don't think so. Literally nothing else looks touched. If something had come in, they'd have robbed us. Nobody's going to break in an apartment and just move a piece of furniture." I searched the apartment top to bottom, ensuring there were no unwanted visitors lurking anywhere. There was not a single sign that anyone had been there. I came back into the living room, where Alice still stood, too confused to do anything. My eyes shifted from her to the chair, still sitting feet away from where it had been the night before. I never considered myself a superstitious person. However, I had seen enough horror movies. I knew the trope of the oblivious couple given 1,000 red flags that something wrong was happening, but never do anything about it until it was too late. "Yeah, we're getting rid of this thing." Alice nodded without a word. We agreed to get it out of the apartment into the dumpster that evening, as neither of us had time to carry it down the steps before work. Given that we were already living from paycheck to paycheck, we couldn't afford to be late. That night, I finished my shift and went to pick up Alice from her job, as we always did. We didn't say much on the drive home. I think we were both eager to just get there and get rid of the chair. As we climbed the stairs to our apartment, I groaned thinking of having to carry that heavy thing all the way back out. Once we reached our door and I slid my key into the lock, we heard it. A high-pitched, blood-curdling scream coming from inside our home. It sounded like a child. I swung the door open as quickly as I could and rushed through the hallway into the living room. Alice quickly followed behind me. The screaming stopped upon us running in. There was the chair, tipped over on its side. Again, not a single other thing was out of place. No sign that anyone had been here. I stormed through every room. "Who the fuck is here?" I screamed, checking every closet, every dark corner, every single fucking inch of that house, but found nothing. I came back to the front door. Alice stood out in the hall, too afraid to come inside. "All right, we're getting this fucking thing out of here now." I grabbed her by the hand and led her in. Without another word, we picked it up and began our descent to the dumpster. I spent the whole trip down, grasping the chair until my knuckles turned white, scared that it would somehow slip out of my hands and go plummeting down the stairs, taking one or both of us with it. I think Alice was scared of the same thing. We managed to get it outside, both of us throwing the thing on the gravel next to the dumpster and letting out a sigh of relief. It was then that I made the discovery, which still haunts me. I noticed a lump in the bottom cushion that I had somehow not seen before. Desperate to find out if something was actually going on with this or if we both were simply going insane, I took my pocket knife from my keychain and began to slice the leather cushion open. Shoved within the stuffing, I found the source of the lump. I pulled out a small, white silk bag, tied with a drawstring. I looked to Alice, who was visibly terrified. My hands were shaking. I didn't want to open it up, but I could feel that something was inside. I pulled the drawstring apart and peered through the opening, immediately dropping the bag onto the ground, the contents spilling out. Alice gasped. There was hair, several different colors, clearly from several different people. There were teeth. There were beaded bracelets and plastic rings made to fit tiny wrists and tiny fingers. There were the bones of the hands that once wore them. We called the police before even saying a word to each other. The cops came. They took the evidence, chair and all. We got a call from a detective the following week. The objects found were at least a decade old. The teeth were from 8 different children, all between the ages of 5 and 7. They tested the victim's DNA, but none of it came up as a match in their system. They took the whole damn chair apart, searching for any evidence they could find from the attacker. But there were hundreds of fingerprints on it. Mine, Alice's, a few workers from the thrift store that it had been dropped off at, and any thrift shopper who had touched it. The police investigated what they could, reached out to the thrift store employees to see if anyone remembered who brought the chair there, and questioned any of the shoppers they could identify through the fingerprints. All in all, they came up with nothing. Nothing else strange happened in our apartment after that, but the presence of the chair still hung in the air. We moved out after our lease was up. I think the children that were killed were trying to tell something, trying to get someone to find what was hidden in that chair. It hurts to know that the victims couldn't be identified. No closure to weeping parents. No honoring the dead with a picture or a name. But the thing that eats away at me the most is that the murderer could still be alive, still taking children from their homes. He might never be caught.
It's a strange shift, isn't it? The parent who raised you needs some help, and you want to be there. With Care.com, you don't have to do it alone. Whether you're clear on the kind of care your aging loved one needs or still figuring it out, we've got support. Find background-checked in-home senior caregivers for anything from companionship to dementia care, or browse senior living communities, read reviews, even schedule a tour, plus access to safety checks to help with your peace of mind. Still not sure what's best? Our senior care advisors, who are all master's-level social workers, can help you build a plan. For a limited time, use the code PODCAST20 for 20% off your initial Care.com subscription. That's PODCAST20, all one word, good for 20% off. Start your senior care journey with confidence.
Hello, America. It's your new favorite podcast here.
Yes, it's James and Andy, 2/4 of the British podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do facts. We do weird facts, fun facts, facts you've never heard before. James, give us a fact.
Did you know you may be able to cure chronically blocked noses with a snot transplant?
Lovely, lovely facts.
If you want to hear us, go to wherever you get your podcasts and search for No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We'll see you there.